Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick, he's Dan, and Dan, this is one of the most underrated weeks of the year, in my opinion. Everyone talks about Selection Sunday, and then they're ready for the big Thursday and Friday to kick off March Madness, but really, it all starts this week with, today, I snuck out of work, not really, the whole office pretty much went, but we went and took a two-hour lunch to watch the UC game. At noon. This is a great time of year. This entire week leading up to the NCAA tournament is highly underrated, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. The next 3 weeks are sort of like a banquet of college basketball. And the best thing about championship week is that there's basketball all day, pretty much every day of the week, whereas once the tournament starts, it's just Thursday through Sunday. But I want to talk – I think we need to begin more specifically with your appearance on the Sports Authority on Channel 12 last week. And the question was asked, who did the panelists, yourself, Northern Kentucky radio legend Richard Skinner, and former UC walk-on John Meeker, about who you guys thought was going to win the NCAA tournament? And you picked Indiana, which seems reasonable, but Richard Skinner did something really strange, and I think we need to set the record straight on what went on there.
Yeah, so Skinner busts out he says he's going off the reservation, right? And he had just said like Michigan State like a week or two before. So I'm thinking that's probably where he's going, or maybe he's switching over to Kansas or something despite their Big 12 loss. But no, he does something else. He says UCLA. And apparently my face must have been rather humorous at this point, because I got several texts and emails, as well as, you sent me an email about this. And now granted, I don't think this is as ridiculous as it sounds to pick UCLA. And for the record, I love Richard Skinner.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Your face looked like Mike Myers when Kanye West dropped the George Bush doesn't care about black people comment.
Which is one of my favorite videos in the history of YouTube. I watch it like once a month. I was like, wait, what? Because, again, I love Skinny. He's my guy. He's helped me out with a lot of stuff when I've tried to start this media career here, or lack thereof. But I don't think this is as bad of a pick as it looks on the surface, because I do think UCLA is really talented. Ben Howland is crazy, but he has taken his team to three Final Fours in a row. I mean, I don't think it was that ridiculous necessarily in this year where there's so much parity, but the timing of it is bizarre. I mean, they just lost to Washington State last week and barely beat Washington this week. I don't understand why he decided like now was the time to go pick UCLA when he hadn't been touting them at all leading up to now.
Well, Rick, a few weeks ago, I think I picked Butler to win the national title, and they lost, what, 5 A-10 games this year? So I don't think Skinny's pick is totally off the reservation, but it is pretty much crazy when you consider the talent at the top of the Big Ten. The other question I had for you is the Butler game on Saturday. You were up at Hinkle Fieldhouse, so was Brian. So we're all the Xavier media types. And my question for you is, who disgraced themselves more in their blubbering over the Butler Bulldogs, Brian Snow or Shannon Russell?
Well, first of all, can we talk about this for a second? The fact that it was a changing of the collar as they were retiring Blue 2 and introducing Blue 3. Great. I get it. Great thing for media. They can shoot it, put it on the news. I get why you do it. But that should have been a 30-second to 1 minute deal before the game, which they did do a ceremony before the game. But then again at halftime, they brought both the dogs back out and did this whole big ceremony that involved multiple rounds of like people standing up and clapping and reporters like crushing each other, sprinting across the court to run and dive and get their cameras so they didn't miss every second of the ceremony that was about to take place.
One of them being Brian Snow.
And they had these freaking dogs on court for basically the entire halftime. And so Snow is like, I'm going to touch Blue too. And so like I'm sitting here blasting this whole deal on Twitter, and Snow reaches down and pets the thing, and I'm like, oh my God. But it was walking by him, so it wasn't that bad. But little do I know, they do this whole deal at halftime. I crush them even more on Twitter. And Snow sneaks down to court level to get a pet of Blue 3 and then tweets about it bragging, to which someone responded that he sounded like a six-year-old kid. So as for your question about who disgraced themselves more, I believe you're referring to Shannon tweeting out how much she loved Bulldogs and live tweeting basically the ceremony that was over the top ridiculous. I'm going to have to go with Snow because women like cute dogs. That's just what they do. But like, come on, Snow.
Rick, I'm going to tell you something. That tirade you just went on right there, it works for me. But I'm going to tell you, if you end up at some point in your career covering either the University of Georgia or Texas A&M, and you go on a tirade like that, you may want to send your dental records to the nearest police station because you may be disappeared.
Yeah, except for the fact that Texas A&M won't happen because I won't cover a team that takes – or a city – live in a city that takes dogs ceremonies that seriously. I mean, if we were going to the dog show, fine.
Texas A&M has their past Reveilles, which is the name of all the dogs, their dog mascots. They have a graveyard for them outside Kyle Field, and they actually have a scoreboard in the dog graveyard that shows the current score of the football games. I am not making this up. All right, let's talk about Xavier basketball. We've already gone on for about 10 minutes without even – broaching the subject, and it's unfortunate because X actually did not have too bad of a week. They beat St. Louis at home on Wednesday night, a really good game. Maybe for my money, the best Xavier's played all year, 77-66 in overtime. On Saturday, they went to Hinkle Fieldhouse and played a phenomenal college basketball game against Butler. Didn't have enough to beat the Bulldogs on senior night up there on changing of the collar night. 67-62 was the final. Xavier finishes the regular season 17-13, 9-7 in the Atlantic 10. They will enter the Atlantic 10 tournament as the 7 seed. They play tomorrow, I believe it's 6:30 p.m. Thursday at 6:30 p.m. I should say, because you're probably going to hear this on Thursday, against St. Joseph's. The winner of that game will play VCU in the quarterfinal on Friday.
Well done. That's a good setup right there. So let's start with the St. Louis game. I mean, I think it's only right. This was a big win for this team, and it proved, I think if nothing else, it proved that this team is capable of playing with anyone in the conference, like we've said all year, but they did confirm that, and it shows that maybe there's a chance this week. Because, I mean, for my money, St. Louis is the best team in this conference that I've seen live and in person. And that includes better than VCU, and that includes Butler. As far as what they do, five positions on the court, St. Louis impresses me, and I think they make it tougher on you to guard them than any team in the conference.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I was really impressed with St. Louis's personnel. They're very deep. They have a lot of guys that can shoot. They have a lot of good basketball players. They have a bunch of guards that can drive and shoot effectively. I think the thing that impresses me the most about them is their discipline as a team. They don't seem to take bad shots too often. They seem to stay in their lanes defensively. And we knew going into Wednesday's game that it was going to take a big effort from X to win that game. I mean, they were 4-point underdogs, 4 or 5-point underdogs.
Well, I mean, hell, I crushed them on the last podcast talking about how they were going to have no chance. But what you just said is the reason why I said that, because SLU is so disciplined and so good in the half court, and they take good shots, and they don't, you know, just get hurried into a bad shot because Xavier's not letting them into the lane. They play well in the half court, which is what Xavier likes to do, is play slower and at a lower scoring pace, but I thought it'd be too tough for him to overcome.
Well, I'm going to throw down – we do a lot of bold statements on this podcast because there's no one there to tell us we're wrong for the most part. But Travis Taylor's performance against St. Louis on Wednesday night may have been the best rebounding effort by a Xavier big man I've ever seen, and may have been the best all-around effort by a Xavier big man since David West's infamous 47-18 against Keith Wallace-Kowski in Dayton, you know, 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah, David West
he was everywhere in that game. 19 points, 19 rebounds in 43 minutes, including the overtime. He had six block shots. I mean, just absolute dominance over St. Louis's front court. And it's sort of telling when you look at the shooting percentages and the shooting performances by the forwards for St. Louis. None of them had a particularly good day, and a lot of that has to do with the all-out effort from Travis Taylor on both ends in that game.
Well, he was unbelievable, and I know some people, you know, you were just making all those bold statements. Someone said that's probably the best senior night performance by a Xavier player in history of Xavier basketball. It probably is, but, like, does anyone actually keep track of that? Like, I don't ever remember senior nights. You know what I mean? Like, they like, asked me that as a question. They kind of, like, made a statement but put a question mark at the end of it, and I was like, I mean, yeah, I'd say so, but literally I can't think of one other senior night performance to compare it to. So I don't think we genuinely or generally think of those as big games to, like, remember. But, yeah, incredible performance by Travis Taylor, and it just so happened that it was against a very good team in St. Louis. The other person that I'm going to say was pretty underrated in this game, Samaje Christen was really good too, by the way. He filled up the stat sheet,
27-7.
Right, 7 boards, 7 assists. But the other guy who was really underrated, Isaiah Fillmore. He played 38 minutes in this game, which was third most on the team and tied his season high up until this point. Finished with 8 points, 4 boards, but which wasn't like great offensively, but defensively against Dwayne Evans. Dwayne Evans gave them some trouble on like 2 possessions early in the game, and he's been on fire recently, just dominating people in the post, mostly off of just bullying on the low block and powering through guys. And Fillmore bodied him up, pushed him off the block, and really held him down. And it seemed like as soon as he kind of brought that presence inside and helped Xavier become a little more physical on both defense and on the glass, the momentum kind of shifted in Xavier's favor.
I would agree with that. But we'll talk more about Fillmore when we talk about the Butler game, because he was outstanding in that game. But I want to talk about Samaje's game against St. Louis. I went to the game with a friend of mine who big college basketball fan, doesn't hit too many Xavier games. And he asked me what I thought of Samaje's performance this year. And I was like, you know, he's a freshman, but he'll do 2 or 3 things a game that you'll just look at and you'll be like, yeah, that's a first round NBA type talent. And I think Samaje did about 6 or 7 of those things in this game. One of them being the pull-up 3 in the first half, which we've not seen from him at all this year. And he did the same thing against Butler, by the way, in a key situation too. And then just in the second half, when St. Louis was, you know, X got back into the game early in the, they really were at sea in the first half. I mean, X got a little bit of a lead early. They went into one of those lengthy droughts. They were looking like they were going to get down double digits. It was 8 or 9 points for a while. They get it back to 4 at halftime. They come out in the second half and immediately jump on St. Louis. And from there, it was a dogfight. And I really thought Samaje, just every time X needed a bucket in that game, or every time they needed a big pass, they needed a big defensive stop, he was there. And I was so impressed with his effort. I thought D. Davis had a pretty poor game. I mean, he had 5 assists, but all around it was not his best game. Samaje picked up the slack, I thought, and this was, for me, I had thought the Purdue game was the best I'd seen from him this year, but I think this is the best that I've seen from him this year.
Yeah, you know what? You might be right. This is definitely up there as far as his performances. I mean, it's top 3 at very worst, and it might be the best he played. And I think what you talked about there with his 3-point shooting, what we saw in that game and then what we saw in the Butler game, and some of just the pull-up jumpers we see throughout the year randomly that maybe don't necessarily come on a great shooting night, so you don't think of it all as he shot the ball really well. But some of the isolated shots we've seen him hit this year, just for all the people on the board who are like completely sold against the fact that he could be an NBA pick next year after his sophomore season is over, that's what you've got to look at. Okay, he works his tail off in the offseason. He's gotten a ton better since this point last year. And he got a ton better at that point from the point the year before. He improves immensely every year that we've seen him so far. He blew up after a junior year of virtually being unknown to becoming one of the hottest point guard prospects in the nation as a senior in high school. He's going to get better quickly. We've seen that from him already. The fact that we've seen him look pretty competent shooting the basketball from the outside in isolated incidents means that the potential's there. It's not like he has the most broke shot in the world to where you're like, this guy's never going to be able to shoot from the outside. His shot looks pretty good when it goes in. And sometimes even when it doesn't, it's a pretty stroke. He jumps a little too high, maybe that keeps it from being consistent enough. There's some things he'll have to tweak, but it's in there. And I'm not completely sold that we won't see it next year. And if that's the case, he's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't think there's any question about that. I think one of the big things about this game, from a Xavier perspective, again, was the defensive effort. Chris Mack alluded to it in his comments going into the A-10 tournament, talking about the heart of this team and that they may not win the A-10 tournament, but they're going to go down fighting. I don't remember what his exact words were, but they were to that. They were sort of to that end.
They have to rip our hearts out of our chests.
St. Louis shot 22 of 73 from the field in Wednesday's game. That's 30%, 7 of 30 from three-point range. My man, Cody Ellis, man. I'll tell you what. You show up with a blue stripe down the center of your head, you can't go 0 for 15.
You can't. Bottom line, like, and some chick hit me up on Twitter because I said that, and she was like, he stripes his head every game. I said, I don't care. Every city you go to is a new city. We just saw it for the first time, which means he can't go 0 for 15 when he does that. There's not a time limit on that. Like, oh, if you do it every night, the next night you're allowed to go 0 for 15. No, you can't stripe your hair a color, look like a Smurf skid mark on top of your faux hawk, and go 0 for 15, especially in another city. You just can't do it. Now, I will say the USA chant. Got to stop doing that one. That's a bad look.
No, I'm not. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. You're not going to get any argument from me. I didn't like it when they used to do it with the GW
Cool
teams with Cool and Masharikov. I don't like it now. Bottom line, these kids want to come to the United States to go to our colleges and to play basketball. Come on.
Not to mention you had an international prospect who Xavier's trying to court right now, sitting courtside at the game while you were
talking. And we'll certainly come back to that. Rick, I want to talk about one incident from the game. Overtime, Jordair Jett, Brad Redford. What in the world happened there?
What about that? Brad Redford. It was not his first career block shot, actually, which I was surprised to find out. But it did tie a career high, not surprisingly. Yeah, I think that was about the most unfitting way for Brad Redford's career at the CentOS Center to end. With absolutely, and it wasn't like he tipped a shot on a jumper. It was like Jordair Jett in the lane going up, and Redford just rejecting that, return to sender, swatting it out of bounds. Very impressive stuff from Redford.
It was, I think, the second most surprising thing I've ever seen in a game at CentOS Center.
With Martin's pass being the first.
The second most surprising good thing, okay. Let's say, because the first one would be C.J. Anderson throwing in a three at the end of the LaSalle game a few years ago, which, first of all, is surprising enough in and of itself, but also to secure a backdoor cover because I think the line on the game was 13.5, and C.J.'s 25-footer made it a 14-point game. There were probably a lot of people in Vegas happy with Wheeze at that point, But yeah, that was pretty remarkable. Rick, I thought if you're going to pick nits about the St. Louis game, and it's a little bit unfair to do so because it was such a great win, but X really did not do a good job of closing out this game in regulation. That they never should have gone to overtime. And was it just a matter of poor foul shooting? I thought it had more to do with the fact that Xavier wasn't intelligent in the last minute about getting the ball in the hands of good foul shooters.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Although, I mean, D. Davis, I feel comfortable with him going to the line if I'm Coach Mack. I don't think that's necessarily a bad guy to go to the line. He goes just one of two with, you know, and he could have made two that would have helped and made it 59-54 instead of just 58-54, but at least he pushed it to two possessions. The problem is St. Louis came up with some big shots. I mean, Mike McCall turned around and nailed a three right after that that then made it a one-point game. So now that that one free throw is a big deal. Then Davis does it again, goes one for two, and you're only up two. So I agree with you that they probably should have, you know, I mean, the problem is who do you get it to on this team? Redford?
Well, there was one situation, I think, with about a minute to go where X broke the sort of the press that St. Louis had. They got the ball to Redford.
And he threw it to Taylor.
And he threw it to Travis Taylor in a really tough situation. He was double teamed and he turned the ball over. I mean, that in particular was one of those things that that's just, you know, we talk about winning plays. That was not a winning play. I mean, that was a bad play by the Musketeers.
And but, see, that's the problem. You can't. It's tough to give it to Brad because he's not really a ball handler and a guy who handles those situations well. So,
right.
And he's the only guy you can really count on this team to hit free throws.
No, that's true. Well, let's move on and talk about the Butler game because I thought that was actually the more interesting game of the two, even though X just got a wonderful win over St. Louis. And I thought it was just, you know, it was the high point of the home schedule for me. And there's actually been some good games this year. X has had, you know, the Temple game was a great win. The Dayton game was a great win. The Butler game, the Memphis game. But I thought the St. Louis game was the best performance at home all season. So that was really cool that the senior class was able to go out on that high.
Can I add real quick on that SLU game? I do think you mentioned they didn't close that game out in regulation. But I do think we saw some growth from this team, and actually we did see all these close finishes that they've had throughout the regular season pay off there because St. Louis really looked discombobulated in overtime themselves. I mean, they didn't play well down the stretch other than the couple tough shots they hit in regulation to send it to overtime. They made bad decisions, and they had a couple bad turnovers that kind of helped Xavier out, which they haven't been in all the close games that Xavier's been in.
Oh, I'd agree with that 100%. I thought St. Louis looked shocked that they were playing overtime, and it showed in their play. I think they were 1 of 11 from the field. They gave up. I think on their first possession there was a travel. Their second possession they turned the ball over. They gave up two dunks in the first. I think in the first four possessions for X in the overtime, and they got themselves behind by 6 or 7 points very quickly. And X really was just managing things from there on in. Yeah. But, yeah, moving on to the Butler game, you know, I was not at the game, but had well-placed sources at the game. They tell me a great atmosphere, as you would expect. When Hinkle Fieldhouse is full, it is it's a hornet's nest. And, boy, Butler lived up to all their billing. They played certainly much better than Xavier fans saw them earlier this year in November. But I thought X, I mean, you mentioned to me in an email that you thought X had played one of their best games of the year in that loss, and I'd have to agree with that.
Yeah, they played extremely hard. I mean, you look at Samaje finished shots in this one too. He had a really good game again, back-to-back games. And after we've kind of talked about him hitting a wall, because he was having a lot of trouble finishing there for a while and just making shots, and he was turning the ball over a ton, he has another great game at Butler with 20 points, 5 assists, 2 steals, only 2 turnovers. And just, I mean, some of the shots and the body control he shows in the lane, it reminds me of watching Chad Johnson in his prime when he was with the Bengals. Like, some of the Gumby-type things he pulls off are just incredible, and that was the case in this game, plus the incredible pull-up three that we haven't seen from him when it mattered. That was big, and he made 7 of 8 free throws. Just a really good game for him. And the other guy I thought played really well in this game is D. Davis, because he's so important against that Butler offense. And while Rodney Clark still got off and had a big game, D did a good job of making him work for it and making it tough on other guys. I thought they did a really good job of defending Butler in this game, but unlike the first game at CentOS, Butler hit a lot of tough shots in this game at Hinkle.
Yeah, I thought the difference was Kellen Dunham. Kellen Dunham hit several running threes. The other difference was Cameron Woods, and this is one of those situations where you're a coach, you look at the other team, and you say, who are we going to make beat us? You know, we don't want Rodney Clark to beat us. We don't want Kellen Dunham to beat us. We don't want Andrew Smith to beat us. We don't want Kyle Marshall to beat us. Well, Cameron Woods, here's a guy, you know, hasn't been that impressive this season. Coming off the bench, you know, we'll give him pull-up jumpers. And you know what? The guy came through. It was almost similar to Fuller from Vanderbilt, who X pretty much had decided from jump that this guy is not going to beat us. We're going to slough off and we're going to concentrate on their other players. And the guy scores 25 points and Vanderbilt wins. I mean, I thought it was sort of the same thing. And the biggest play of the game, as Chris Mack mentioned in his post-game press conference, was down the stretch, 58-58 with, I don't know, a minute 40 to play, something like that. 2:11 to play. Travis Taylor hits a layup to tie the game at 58. Butler calls a timeout. They spend 20 seconds working the ball, and they finally get it to Cameron Woods, open on the left baseline from, I don't know, 16, 17 feet, a shot that Xavier is perfectly comfortable letting that guy take, and he knocked it down without hesitation. And that was the game. I mean, I really think that X had the right defense for the situation they were in. But sometimes the guy that you don't think is going to be the hero is the hero. And you just have to sort of put your hands up and say, we gave it our best go. It's the same thing we saw earlier this year with Butler when they ISO'd Alex Barlow on Jordan Halls in the last seconds of an overtime game against Indiana, and a walk-on makes a shot and Butler beats Indiana when they were number one in the country. That's just the way it goes sometimes, I guess.
Funny. I'll always remember Cameron Woods really well because it was my first year out on the circuit, I believe, either that or my second year, but it was one of the first tournaments I had really covered and done a lot of stuff with, especially looking at Xavier prospect. And the first time I ever saw Travis Steele was him watching Cameron Woods, and it was like a day or two after Butler had decided to offer him. And I remember seeing him there watching him. I was like, yeah, I wonder if they'll offer. And then, you know, I think they did, but like the next week he committed to Butler. He also was watching Jalen Reynolds at that tournament, which was the first time I saw Jalen Reynolds. So I'll always remember Cameron Woods for sure because of that. But he was, you mentioned it. I mean, that three, or not three, but the jump shot he hit from the short corner was just a giant momentum killer. And Xavier then, after that, it was like, and it was like that up to this point, but you kind of thought that they got the shot they wanted. They were maybe finally going to be able to get that stop, keep the game tied, and then go ahead and make Butler chase them. It just never happened. The rest of the game, they were chasing points, and then finally Fillmore doesn't finish on that isolation play on the block, and they go up by two possessions, and the game's over. But Xavier, other than that, this game was – these teams were almost identical the entire game. They played each other shot for shot. They defended each other well. It was an absolute war in the paint on the boards, which I expected it to be. But, I mean, Isaiah Fillmore, it wasn't quite Travis Taylor's game of rebounding. There wasn't a lot of guys, like, jumping for rebounds, and they had Cameron Woods to kind of counteract him. It was a perfect matchup for him. There was a lot of bodies being pushed around in the paint, so it was much more Isaiah Fillmore speed, and he delivered with 16 points and 11 boards.
Fillmore was incredible in this game, and never more so than during that huge 15-4 run that X used to get back in the game early in the second half. Butler had pushed it out to I think they were up 10 points at one point, and it looked like the game was getting away from X. It was one of those things where it didn't feel like X was playing that bad, but Butler was just hitting shot after shot, and X would get good shots and they couldn't finish. And all of a sudden you look at the scoreboard and it's 10 points, and you're like, well, how did that happen? But it's just because Butler is such an efficient team in the way they play offense. But, I mean, if you want to get down to why Xavier lost this game, Butler did not have an empty possession after the 3:10 mark. Yep. They scored on every possession after the 3:10 mark of the second half. I mean, it's pretty easy to finish a game when you do that, right?
Yeah, you've got to be able to get a stop if you're Xavier there. And that's exactly what Xavier said. They just couldn't get that one stop. And they had gotten stops all game. It's not like they weren't playing hard. You got to give a lot of credit to Butler because they shoot the ball well. They make tough shots. They execute to death. And they rebound well on top of it. So if they happen to miss a shot, they often get a second possession. They're very tough to handle in those situations. And they are stone cold down the stretch of games. I mean, they don't make mistakes. Xavier comes up short. I don't think anyone leaves that game thinking that, you know, Xavier's struggling or losing any momentum after that, though. I think, you know, they played great in the SLU game. They played really well in that Butler game and just didn't quite do enough down the stretch defensively to win it. But you still feel like, at least to me, as we transition into talking about this Atlantic 10 tournament, that Xavier's playing its best basketball of the year. The biggest reason I say that, all year we've talked about this team needs someone else who can score, right? They need that Jeff Robinson or Justin Martin to step up. And we talked about all year that Isaiah Fillmore was maybe that guy. Finally, late in the season, he's become that guy. And I don't know, he said, you know, he thought maybe he was getting his legs back a little bit. Coach Mack said he really thought it was a lot about his confidence and finding out that Isaiah needs, he said he needs to be a he's a positive reinforcement guy. Some guys need to be kicked in the butt. Other guys need a pat on the back and say, hey, good job. He said Isaiah's needed a lot of good jobs from the Xavier coaching staff, but it's really helped and he's played well. You look at Xavier over the last couple weeks. Yes, they're 3-4, but the schedule was so backloaded. They've played the toughest portion of it and really they've played well enough sans the Dayton game to win any of those other games, VCU, UMass, or Butler, in those losses against good teams. I'd argue that Xavier's peaking at the right time. I think they're playing their best basketball right now. The biggest reason being that Isaiah Fillmore gives them another scorer and a guy who's different from Travis Taylor. He's not just a garbage points guy or a guy who can maybe create a little bit with his back to the basket. He can go isolation in the short corner and create his own shot a little bit too.
Yeah, X played a couple of their best games during that period of time. And I think Brian Snow made a good point, believe it or not, when he wasn't sniffing various Bulldogs' butts or running for Pope, as he said on Twitter today, which would have been something.
It truly would have. I'm sure the Catholics would have been happy about that.
he did make a good point that if not for D. Davis's concussion, X may well have won two of those games that they lost. I mean, the UMass game and the VCU game were both turned in large part because X didn't have that primary ball handler for large portions of the game. But, you know, that's water under the bridge at this point. We have to look forward to the Atlantic 10 tournament starting tomorrow. X enters as the 7 seed, as I mentioned at the top of the program. They're going to play St. Joe's, number 10. In the first round, game starts at 6:30 p.m. and I believe it's on NBC Sports. Is the television situation? You need to follow that during the A-10 tournament because I think they're on different networks every single round. Yep. This will end next year, by the way. But yeah, so St. Joe's as the first round matchup. It's going to be Vegas line is going to be a pick 'em, maybe even St. Joe's as a favorite. You look at the Pomeroy rankings, that jibes with what they've had to say. Xavier lost by 10 points at St. Joe's this year. It was a game that probably wasn't really a 10-point game. I think X was up 2 with 4 minutes left, and they never scored again. But the thing is that in the last 12 years, Xavier has been in a position, I believe, where they needed to perform in the A-10 tournament to make the NCAA tournament on 3 occasions. And the first one of those, they went out and they beat a number 1 undefeated St. Joe's team by 20 points and then beat Dayton on their home court to win the A-10 tournament and an automatic bid on their way to the Elite Eight. The second time, they swept four games in 4 days at U.S. Bank Arena, beating St. Joe's in the final with Justin Dolman's infamous block shot with 2 seconds left to clinch the final. And then the third time was last year when X entered the A-10 tournament in kind of disarray, I would have to say, after the extended drought they suffered after the UC brawl and all the suspensions and so forth. And they beat Dayton and they beat St. Louis and they got to the final and they secured an at-large bid with those wins. So the last 3 times X has gone into the A-10 tournament needing wins to go forward, they've gotten them. Will that continue this year, Rick? Tough to say.
Yeah, it's well, the biggest part is they've got probably the toughest road to get there this year. But the thing I look at is this is still Xavier. This is still the Atlantic 10. until they're in a new conference where they have to prove themselves, I'm never going to rule this team out in this conference tournament. Like you said, history is on their side. They know that. They've got a lot of confidence. The staff is going to preach that to them and has been doing so over the last 36 hours. I look at the St. Joe's team, though. I still think it's a very tough matchup because, end of the day, they're in a do-or-die, one-game scenario, have to win or their season's over as well. And they've got a lot of talent. They haven't played to their full potential this year. They're not as good as a team as the SLUs or VCUs or Butlers. But personnel-wise, I like their talent a lot. I mean, they're really good. They're versatile. They have a little bit of everything. When I look at the last game, Xavier did a pretty good job. I mean, they out-rebounded them against an athletic team that rebounds well. They didn't turn the ball over too much. I don't think that was really the problem in this game. But one thing I did see is Xavier only has 9 free throw attempts in the last meeting against St. Joe's. St. Joe's blocked 9 of their shots. That's just not going to get it done. You've got to challenge their shot blockers, and you've got to be physical inside and score in the paint the way Xavier's done all year when they've been successful. Otherwise, you're going to shoot 34%, and you're only going to score 49 points the way they did the last time these two teams met up.
The key matchup in this game is going to be Isaiah Fillmore and Khalil Kanisevich.
I agree. I agree 100%.
I mean, because Kanisevich is the engine that makes that team run.
The Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, I love that, which I think I coined, maybe.
I think you
but
did,
yeah,
too.
He does everything well. He shoots a three. He's a great passer. He has great body control. He's always in the way defensively. He makes space for guys like Langston Galloway, for Carl Jones, guys who can shoot the three. I mean, he is the thing that makes their offense work. And you can talk about Roberts, you can talk about Aiken, you can talk about the talent they have down low, you can talk about the guys they have on the backcourt that can hit threes, but it all starts with Kanisevich. And if Isaiah Fillmore can be as effective going into him the way he's been in the last, I don't know, 6-7 games, where he's been a very steady influence for Xavier, especially defensively, X has got a good chance. Here's the problem. Let's say X beats St. Joe's. They got to turn around. They got to play VCU. Less than 24 hours rest, or maybe maximum 24 hours rest. VCU doesn't play a game tomorrow. That means that Havoc defense is ready to go against a team that's got tired legs. And that, to me, is why this is a nightmare matchup. I know there were some people, when the seedings came down, I said, I think this is the worst possible matchup, and people disagreed with me. This is why. If X was in a position where they might play VCU in a semifinal or in a final, I wouldn't feel so bad about it because VCU would be worn down the same way. But, man, if you got to play a fresh team with a game under your legs, this is – and this is why this year is different than previous years, because in previous years, when they played these first round games at campus sites, the teams had a couple days to rest before that quarterfinal matchup. And so to a certain extent, the advantage of getting a bye was dissipated by the fact that these teams kept in practice because they got the opportunity to play a game, but they weren't fatigued going into the game. But this year, you do have to do 4 games in 4 days. And so that's why I think X is in has an uphill battle. And the Vegas odds makers apparently agree. If you look at the most recent odds for this, if gambling was illegal in Ohio, St. Louis and VCU are sort of the joint favorites at about 2-1, Temple 6-1, LaSalle 8-1, Butler 11-1, St. Joe's actually 21-1, and Xavier all the way down at like 30-1. In fact, behind UMass, Dayton, Richmond, St. Joe's, teams that are actually seated below them. So it's an uphill battle, but X can look back on their history in this tournament and in this competition, and maybe they can draw some strength from that. Certainly, this is a team that is not going to get outworked. We know this. We've seen it all season long. Chris Mack cited it in his press conference this week. So, you know, hopefully X can get this first win out of the way over St. Joe's, give VCU a run, and boy, if they can get past VCU, it's all open for them. But it's a tough quarterfinal matchup if they get past St. Joe's.
Look, there's no doubt about it. Playing VCU is not going to be an easy task. They're one of the best teams in the conference for a reason. I'll say this, though. After watching that team up close and personal, I don't think that they can score against Xavier's defense if they don't create turnovers. They really, really struggled to get anything going offensively, and they were out of rhythm that entire game until D. Davis gets headbutted, concussed, leaves the game, and they start turning Xavier over constantly and getting easy buckets in transition. And then all of a sudden, they start hitting some shots. But up until that point, they could not score at all against X. In a conference tournament scenario, I think it's tough to get the momentum like that. Now, granted, they did it last time at CentOS, so it's not – I mean, it's not like that it can't be done. But with D. Davis in the lineup for a full game, assuming he doesn't get headbutted again, I think they've got a chance. One other point going back to the St. Joe's game, though, you mentioned the Isaiah Fillmore thing. I agree 100% about that. Just point out this, though. Last time these two teams played, Isaiah Fillmore played 20 minutes, 0 points, 0 for 3 from the field, had 5 rebounds, which was pretty good. But other than that, was pretty much a non-factor, not near the presence he's been and not near as important to the team at that time as he is right now. And he's been playing pretty well, so I agree. I think he could be a big difference this time around against St. Joe's.
Hey, Rick, let's talk about conference tournaments generally. Every year around this time, there's a lot of controversy about this because every year you will see one or two of these small conference teams that have an unbelievable regular season and get upset in their conference tournament and maybe miss the NCAA field. I remember growing up as a kid, X was often that team, right? I mean, they would be playing in the MCC. They go, you know, 13-3 or 12-2 or whatever. And then they would find themselves playing at Dayton in an MCC conference final, maybe again, or at Evansville or something like that, playing on the road to try and get that NCAA slot. Do you think, what's your sort of view on conference tournaments? Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing? And if it's a bad thing, what should we be looking at to try and resolve these problems that apparently exist?
Well, I would like to see it. The thought, here's the thing, the sentiment of you're the best team in your conference all year. You have a great conference season. You go nearly undefeated or lose one game, and then you get in your conference tournament, lose one game, and all of a sudden that now undoes what you've put together over the course of a season. I don't necessarily agree with that thought process, but here's the problem. They make too much money off these conference tournaments. They need to be important. There needs to be a reason for people to show up to them. There needs to be made for TV moments where, you know, there's that David and Goliath moment in the finals. You get to watch Western Kentucky pull a big upset to go dancing again. I mean, those are great moments, and that's why it's set up the way it is, I think. So I don't think we're going to see it change. Now, maybe the solution, and someone else suggested this, I can't remember who the author was or I'd cite them, but they wrote about it this week that they need to figure out some sort of system to where if the conference champion from the regular season gets to the finals and loses, they'd play one more game against whoever that other team was, and they'd have to beat them twice. I agree with that. The problem is I don't know how you schedule all that. And even still, you still got the same problem if that team loses in the first or second round, if they don't get to the finals. And then I don't like the idea of giving them – Lance McAllister today on the radio was saying that they should give them a bye to the finals and just let them play one game in the finals against someone and they have to be beaten twice. But I don't like that either because I think you're at a disadvantage sitting while other teams are playing three games and getting momentum. I think, you know, there's something to the fact that you can tire out over a three- or four-game tournament, but there's also something to the effect of picking up momentum. You know, I don't know if I buy all that.
Well, let me tell you why I hate conference tournaments. And it has to do with March 5th, 1995. Nutter Center, Dayton, Ohio. Wright State, Delmi Harriman, 71-70 over Xavier. Probably the most traumatic sporting event I've ever attended in person. It was... Yeah, Vitaly Potapenko fouled out early and X couldn't make a foul shot and Skip Prosser somehow got called for a technical foul at halftime. Still sticks in my craw,
clearly,
to be honest.
Clearly.
And Oh, X, by the way, was 14-0 in the MCC that year. And so the bottom line is, I absolutely hate the idea that a team can, over the course of a 16 or 18 game schedule, win their conference and then be locked out of the NCAA tournament. I love the fact that the NIT has offered automatic bids to those teams that win their conferences and then lose in the conference tournament. I think that's a nice consolation prize. I think it's appropriate that those teams that have won championships on the floor should be allowed to continue their season in the postseason. But man, there's got to be a better way.
Yeah, I just don't know what.
And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. I think maybe the answer is something like what the West Coast Conference has done, which is that they have basically put together a system of buys where the first two finishers in their conference go directly to the semifinals, and everybody else has to fight it out in Thunderdome to get there. And those teams get a couple days rest. The teams that have to fight their way through, they have to play a couple games to get there, so they don't have the advantage of being game tested without fatigue the way the A-10 has been the last couple of years. But there's something that just seems to me profoundly unfair about having a 30-game season and then deciding who's going to go to the NCAA tournament in 4 days at a neutral site, or worse yet, at the site of some other team. I mean, that Wright State game that I'm talking about was played at Wright State's home court, who was the number 8 seed in that tournament, upsetting the number 1 seed, who was undefeated in the league. So, you know, I think there's a profound unfairness about it. But as with everything else, fairness and competitive balance goes in the toilet when money is involved.
Well,
and that's another example of that, I suppose. But yeah, I agree. I sort of like what Lance is saying. I sort of like the idea of having having something like they do in Aussie rules football and in rugby in some places, of having a repechage or something like that, where if you win your league and you lose in the playoffs, you get to come back at the end. Where where if you're the regular season champion, you have to be beaten twice while everybody else has to be beaten once. I like the possibility of having protections like that in the playoff system, but yeah, I mean, but by the same token, conference tournament week is awesome because there's games every day. There's always something to watch. There's always a good finish going on.
Well, and there's been some incredible moments brought to us by conference tournaments over the years. Let's go ahead and what's your favorite conference tournament moment? I mean, if you thinking back, what is that moment that you'll always remember?
I think it was Romain Sato hitting a three with 12 minutes left in the A-10 quarterfinal in 2003 to put Xavier up 74-37 on number 1, 28-0 St. Joe's. I think that was the most awesome thing I've ever seen. I was sitting in UD Arena in the 300 level with my dad. We'd driven up from Cincinnati that day just on the spur of the moment, figuring out what the hell, we'll see what happens. And it was the most dominant performance I've ever seen from a basketball team, the way Xavier played that day.
Well, I don't have a Xavier memory. My favorite moment will always be I don't see how this will ever be topped. Will be that 6 overtime game between Syracuse and UConn in 09. Johnny Flynn was incredible for Syracuse. And for UConn, it was Stanley Robinson and A.J. Price leading the charge. I mean, I got home for that game. I was out somewhere. I can't remember where. I get home in the fourth quarter and then got to see an entire game and a half still. It was like the best night of basketball ever. And I'm not even ashamed to say I didn't see it from start to finish, because that would have been way too much. I saw the part I needed to see. It was an unbelievable game where neither team would just give in and lose. And I don't think I'll ever forget watching that game on my parents' couch that night. It was incredible. That being said,
I'll give you another moment for me, which was the what was it? 2000 and what was the year they won at US Bank Arena? 2007.
Yes, I think so.
That's right. With about 4 minutes left in that game, I was living in Nevada at the time, and I had to drive over to a friend's house. And when I left my house, X was down 10 points. When I got to his parents' house, X had tied the game. And so I'm standing there in their living room surrounded by a bunch of people who didn't care a thing about the game. And I walked in and I'm like, you got to turn on the game. You got to turn on the game. And they're watching me and I was acting like a complete jackass. And when X won the game, I was jumping up and down like a complete clown, as you do.
Pretty standard.
And completely amused them. And then what we were doing is we were driving to the Lawler Event Center at the University of Nevada for the WAC final between Nevada and Utah State that day, which went to overtime and was a great game with some fantastic players, Nick Fizikas, Marcellus Kemp, Ramon Sessions. And that was a pretty good 5-hour stretch of college basketball as well.
No question. That being said, Dan, all this, you know, my favorite memory is from the Big East tournament, but how ridiculous is all this sappy writing that we have to read about this year's Big East tournament and how it's so sad that it's going away. You assholes blew it up.
Well, the greatest thing about it is that immediately after all this garbage is written and all these soliloquies and whatever are thrown out there about the glory of the Big East tournament, the first game in this competition is a 46-42 overtime game. That was just that every tape of that ought to be burned. I mean, here's the thing. The funniest thing about it is that so many of the people that are whining about the demise of this competition had nothing to do with the competition being good in the first place. I mean, Mick Cronin's talking about how it's not going to be the old Big East anymore next year. Well, Mick, I hate to tell you, but
you weren't part of the old Big East.
What your school has contributed to the Big East tournament are the following four things. Number one, you lost to 0-18 DePaul. That would be number one. Number two, you lost on a buzzer beater to Jerry McNamara, which was awesome. You lost to a buzzer beater to Deshaun Butler from West Virginia, I think. Number three. And then number four, you scored 44 points in the title game. So I don't think that UC really contributed that much to the Big East during their tenure. So it's a little bit rich to hear people like Mick Cronin and some of the others that have been out there talking about how bad the tournament is going to be denigrated by the loss of these teams. Well, you know what? The Big East is not going to be as good next year as it is this year, but that's because they're losing Louisville and Syracuse and UConn. It's not because they're losing Cincinnati and South Florida and DePaul.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just sick of hearing about it. I mean, we've known it was coming. The conference realignment stuff was happening. Like you said, most of the teams that are whining aren't even the teams involved in the old Big East and the memories that everyone has. So
Pearl Washington. No, we're talking about Pearl Washington. That happened when I was four. Rick, you probably never saw Pearl Washington play, and if you did, you wouldn't remember it.
Exactly.
So let's talk – but while we're on the subject of conferences, let's talk about what's going on with the Big East now. We know officially that we know that the Big East deal is done officially. I think we knew that last week. There's been some public press conferences and so forth. The New York Post issued an article today in big shining type that Butler, Dayton, and Xavier were going to join the Big East next season. It turns out that the author walked that back. He's not quite sure that Dayton is going to join next season. But of course, the Xavier blogosphere, which delights in nothing more than sticking the knife into their neighbors to the north, went crazy about it. Rick, next year, who's going to be in the Big East?
Here's the crazy thing. I'm still – everyone is saying 10 pretty much now. Like everything we read pretty much has it at 10 and then talks about the potential to go to 12 in the future. I'm still hearing people say 9 for the most part on my end as far as my sources go, and that's Xavier and Butler. So if it is going to be 10, I've heard Creighton as the 10th. I have not heard Dayton at all. I've heard Creighton multiple times as potentially being the 10th, but my sources are still holding to the fact that they only expect 9 when the conference starts next year.
Well, one of the interesting things that's been brought up, and there was an article in the New York Times about it, was that it looks like the way the Fox deal is structured, and again, we don't know what the actual contract says. We're just trusting the media reports about it and what Brian has been exposed to, but the way it looks is that from a per school basis, it doesn't really matter if from a TV perspective, if the Big East has 9 teams versus 12, because it looks like the money escalates almost on a, you know, almost on a linear
sliding scale, right?
Yeah, a sliding scale. It's if it's going to be $4 million a team, it's going to be $4 million a team if it's 9, and it's going to be $4 million a team if it's 12. Doesn't that almost put a negative incentive on expansion unless you're bringing in a program that can definitively produce NCAA credits or other monies?
Well, I would certainly say so, and that's why I was surprised to see this, because from everything I've heard, Fox wants to push it to 12 teams as soon as possible. But like you said, I mean, this is offering the teams already involved an incentive to stay at 9, really. I mean, or 10 if you find the worthy 10th, like you said, but and they can come to a consensus. But why would you water your conference down at all if you don't have to? If it doesn't change the money at all, why water it down? I don't understand that at all.
Well, yeah, and I agree with that. And here's my thing. Here's the thing that I'm struggling to understand. I think I sort of understand it. But why is it, do you think, that Xavier fans are so prickly about the possibility of Dayton ending up in this conference?
I mean, I think there's so much between just the Xavier and Dayton fan base that I'll just never really fully understand. But
you're telling me.
But there's so much just dislike, hatred, whatever you want to call it there, that I think it's basically from Xavier's point of view, from the fans, it's they've rode Xavier's coattails for everything, and they're not living up to the hype. And from a just general perspective that it's common sense, you wouldn't want a team that's located 50 minutes away from you to get the same benefits that you're going to have going forward. I mean, that's a team that you're going to be recruiting against. You already have recruited against. You've even lost a guy or two that you wanted to them in the past.
Well, but let's be honest. I mean, what really are the recruiting battles that Xavier's lost to them? I mean, it's Chris Wright and it's Juwan Staten maybe and Josh Benson.
Yeah, not huge, but you certainly don't want to move them into the Big East with you and give them a little more ammunition with Archie Miller there if they're going to keep that program is in a position to keep getting better. They've got a sold-out facility. They've got a great fan base. They've got a good, young, energetic coach. I don't think you want to bring them into the same conference with you again and put them on an even playing field for the most part with you.
Here's my take on it, having been intimately exposed to both fan bases. There is a feeling from Xavier fans that Xavier has earned this. It's like a call-up for a minor league baseball team that's finally, after years of working their way up, they get the call-up to the major leagues. And meanwhile, they sort of view Dayton as their Billy Carter, their drunk brother who hasn't done anything, that's sort of just ridden by on their coattails, that maybe just be getting brought in. And you know what? If you try and construct a basketball-only argument for Dayton, you've got a rough time. But when you look at the other things, like the TV ratings and the attendance and the interest and so forth, they have a compelling argument. So it will be interesting to see if Dayton is included. I think the one thing that we can say is that this report from the New York Post is not true. Dayton is not going to be in the Big East next year. They may be eventually, but it's not going to be next year.
I'm still going on record as I don't think Dayton will be a part of the conference. From everything I've heard, it will not happen.
So you think it's going to be Creighton? Definitely.
I think Creighton will join possibly. I think Creighton will join at some point, but I don't know if
okay,
that
well,
may
let's
be in the
start, let's do this. Let's do this. Percentages. Creighton, 100%. 100%?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Not for next year, no. I don't know. I still think, from what I've been told, that it's going to be at 9. If it's 10, I think it'll be Creighton, yes. And
all right.
I think Creighton does join at some point.
So as of January 1, 2015, Creighton 100%.
I think so, yes.
Okay. Richmond.
See, I really don't know after Creighton. I mean, I don't think – I think St. Louis would be the next best chance of joining. But farther than that, I don't even know if Richmond or Dayton have even been talked to about it, to be honest with you. I don't think they have from what I've heard. So
your opinion is that St. Louis would be
after
in pole position for 11.
Yep.
Now, here's the question that I have. Let's say that St. Louis and Creighton are the next two choices. That would mean the Big East has 7 Midwest teams and 4 Eastern teams, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, well, no, I'm sorry. It would be 6 and 5. Is it really plausible that the Big East would end up with a membership that skews more to the Midwest than the East Coast?
It's a good point. I do think it's possible. I mean, look at conference realignment, Dan. Anything's possible at this point. But I think I could see it happening. I mean, it's not like Dayton's going to be adding an East Coast school to it. That's just another Midwest school.
No, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's why if it gets right to 6 and 5, and you're talking about Creighton and St. Louis coming in, which makes it 6 and 5, isn't it more likely that it's going to be an Eastern school over a Midwestern school
right,
to keep
yeah.
geographic balance right?
Yeah, I think Richmond has a better chance than Dayton.
Okay. So in your view, St. Louis has a higher chance than either Richmond or Dayton?
Yes, in my opinion, right now, yes. I think St. Louis is in the conversation already. I don't know if the other two are.
Mm. Okay. Well, let's moving on, let's talk a little bit about recruiting, because although there hasn't been a whole lot of news recently, there's been a couple of names that have been brought to the fore, Junior Itoh being the first. He was in town for the St. Louis game. He was subjected to the chance that we already talked about. Your thoughts on his recruitment? Is he a guy that's going to come in? Do you think X is all in for this guy, or what's the situation?
Here's the thing on Junior. One, everyone's been talking about he's down to Xavier in Miami and he's about to make a decision. I don't think that's the case. I think Washington actually is still in the mix. And there could be another school or two possibly that we're not real sure about. There's still a lot of movement on this one because, really, to be honest, no one's pushing for a commitment from him right now. Now, that's not to say one school might not take it if he's ready to commit. Like, Xavier may take a commitment from him if he said, hey, I want to commit to Xavier. But the fact is, any team that takes that commitment would know at this point that there's a chance he never suits up for their school. There's a lot to be worked out still with his transcript and his eligibility. It's going to have to go through the NCAA first. You wouldn't find out until late in the process. But at this point, if you're a team like Xavier, who's going to have the open scholarships no matter what, and he's a guy who would come in, be physically mature, be potentially able to contribute right away inside and give you some depth and athleticism and a defensive presence and a rebounding presence probably right away, I think you go ahead and say, what's the risk? I mean, worst case scenario, he's not eligible and you're right where you started, but you weren't going to use those scholarships anyway. The flip side is he's definitely good enough. He'd be a great addition, potentially one that helps you immediately next year on a team that you're expecting to be pretty good that maybe just needs a little added depth. And you know, he does end up eligible. So I think that's basically what you're going to see is a school may take a commitment from him, but just know that even if Xavier takes it, it doesn't mean that, you know, Xavier doesn't know what they're doing recruiting-wise. And yes, it may mean that they lose another recruit to eligibility concerns, but you're doing so with very little risk involved. You know the consequences, and it just puts you right where you're going to be at anyways because there aren't any other guys out there as talented as him that you're going to take or use those scholarships up on.
May I go on a mini, mini rant?
Sure.
Not every time that a kid has eligibility concerns is it the fault of the kid. Sometimes, in the case of this young man, it's because he was born unwittingly. You know, unfortunately, he wasn't born in God's own America. He was born in sub-Saharan Africa. There are all kinds of issues with that. These kids, the kids that come from the international schools, they struggle because the NCAA doesn't have a consistent way of determining college credits and eligibility. We've seen it with guys who were actually good students that just because of the choice of the prep schools they went to or whatever else, they were forced to sit out a year. Miles Davis, a perfect example, a kid that went to a prep school where six or seven of the kids that sat in the classes with him are currently playing Division I basketball, but he is not because the NCAA decided ex post facto that that school was not good enough to qualify, or that school had been banned or whatever. So, you know, the idea that I feel like any time you or Brian bring up the fact that a kid has eligibility concerns, people automatically assume, well, this kid is a moron. That's not really the case. I mean, a lot of kids, the thing you have to appreciate is a lot of these kids, they grow up in very poor circumstances. Their family situations are in flux. They transfer a lot. That's just the way it goes. And sometimes those transcripts, they don't get worked out the way they are. And sometimes guys who can make the grades are not ruled eligible. So I wish people would keep that in mind a little bit, because I think people are way too quick to just denigrate a kid just because it looks like their eligibility is in question.
That, and I love how, you know, it's the coaching staff. The coaching staff gets crushed despite the fact that they may know what they're doing. Like you said, it may be a situation where a kid has eligibility issues through no fault of his own. They know, hey, we're Xavier. We can't necessarily get all these top flight kids, but a kid like this who has eligibility concerns that schools have already passed on, we might be able to get a steal here. They're going to go ahead and try it. It's worked out for them in the past. Mark Lyons, James Posey, say hi. I mean, it's been a strategy that's worked.
And I want to be clear. I'm not a bleeding heart here. There are some kids that are knuckleheads that honestly do not belong in college. And it's up to the coaches involved to figure that out. And I think X has done a pretty admirable job of steering clear of kids like that.
Absolutely.
All right, Rick, another name that's come out in the recruiting game is a young man from Northern Kentucky at Holmes High School. What can you tell us about Mr. Bolden?
Yeah, James Bolden emerged onto the scene. I had him ranked, actually. I cover Northern Kentucky high school sports as part of my other job, and I do preseason rankings for all the players. I had him ranked 11th coming into this year. He was a kid that I saw potential from just flashes last year. He had great handle, good quickness. Had kind of an ugly shot at the time. And so I was like, you know what? He didn't play a whole lot last year, but I'm sure he'll start or play a lot for him this year. So I ranked him 11th out of 15. Well, he's my player of the year now in the postseason. He was incredible all year long. He's extremely quick and slippery with his handle. He has the ball on a string, and he has all types of – the fans are going to love him because he has maybe even better than Drew Lavender floater, which I don't know if that's quite possible.
No. It doesn't exist.
He has a distinct floater. Like, that is his go-to shot right now at such a young age that I don't know where Drew Lavender's floater game was at – as a sophomore in high school.
Rick,
so.
does he have access to beast mode?
I'm not sure about that. I'll have to talk to him about beast mode and see where he stands on that. His nickname is Beetle, though. Not quite as intimidating as Beast, but probably makes a little bit more sense because he didn't give it to himself. That being said, James Bolden, you probably read what Evan said about him. I mean, he's a guy who's going to get a lot more attention. Xavier's already offered, and to be honest with you, they've just seen a lot more of him already than other schools have. They've heard about him early on in the process somehow. I don't know how, but they heard about him, I guess. And so they started showing up pretty early in the season, followed him throughout the year. Coach Mack watched his final game in Northern Kentucky at the 9th Region Tournament. He played very well in that, and so they offered the next day. And I think he's a kid that it's going to be interesting to see. If he grows to gets bigger, he becomes 6'1 or so, he's just under 6 foot, probably about 5'11 right now. If he gets up to like 6'1 or so, he's probably a high major kid. If he stays right around that 6 foot level, it's going to be really interesting to see where it plays out. His 3-point shot's got to get a little bit more consistent, though he showed the ability to knock some huge ones down. I mean, he was 5 of 7 in the second round of the state tournament against Madison Central. So definitely a developing kid who's going to get a lot of exposure this spring and summer playing in the Nike EYBL circuit.
Well, that's yeah, and Chris Mack obviously braved the vicissitudes of dealing with high school logistics getting to that game down at NKU. But yeah. let's talk about some other guys from Kentucky. Shane Hall, what's the situation with that young man?
I think things are a little slow with Shane Hall right now. He didn't have quite the high school season that most wanted. I haven't really heard. Here's the other problem with him. During the high school season, he's in the freaking mountains that no one's going to travel down to go see him play a high school game, really. I mean, they catch him at a tournament or two. I know Xavier watched him once this season.
You might see him in the background of an episode of Justified, but
exactly. I know Xavier went down to watch him once at a tournament in, I think, Lexington this year, and you know, some teams saw him, but just not a whole lot of buzz around him. I mean, there's no media really covering his games, so just not a whole lot out there about him. I think things will probably pick back up with him in the spring. He's always a kid that plays better around better players. On his high school team, he doesn't seem to do much, and people come away thinking, oh, he's disinterested and has a low motor. But then all of a sudden he gets around good players and he really steps it up a level and plays inspired basketball. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens with him in the spring. But right now it's kind of very quiet on his front.
Right, right. And the next question I was going to ask you about was the 2014 class. Because we've talked about it a little bit. Can you explain why this is such an important class for Xavier and what they may be looking for in that recruiting class?
Well, the biggest thing about it is you're going to have a lot of scholarships open in this class. I mean, a lot of guys coming off the books. You already have a couple that from 2013 that you might be
right,
saving.
Right, and Samaje is going to be open too. And I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, there's a decent chance. And even if it's not open, you got to be looked to – have a contingency plan in place for when he leaves. I mean, Brandon Randolph may be your point guard of the future as a junior or whatever, but ideally you might want to play him off the ball anyway. So I think they're definitely looking at point guards in that class. I think they'll look at another actual center, like a Sean O'Mara type from Illinois that we've talked about a little bit. I think they're going to look for someone to replace Stainbrook. So that's definitely going to be a need. And then I think you just look for scorers on the wing after that. I mean, you obviously, as we've seen this year, you can never have enough of that with the way college basketball is right now. And that's something that's been kind of tough for Xavier. I mean, you think you had one in Des Wells, and that didn't work out, obviously. But now they're kind of hurting at that spot. So I think that's sort of it. They've got enough scholarships that they'll probably take just about one of anything they can get that's good enough. So the biggest positions of need probably be in that point guard and center position, but I think they'll look for almost anything. But yeah, it's just big because you're replacing a lot of scholarships in that one class and kind of rebuilding the future of your program at that point.
All right, Rick. Well, one of the big incidents in college basketball recently was Tom Crean getting into a little bit of contretemps with a Michigan assistant during the handshake line after Indiana won the Big Ten in Ann Arbor after a fantastic game, one of the best games of the season. Boy, the Big Ten has just never stopped delivering this year, the great games between the top teams at that league. But yeah, your thoughts on that?
Well, I thought it was hilarious still because Tom Crean, after they shake the hands, I don't know, people claim that Jeff Meyer from Michigan had said something to him in the handshake line initially. There's no proof of that. What we do have great video evidence of, though, is Crean running back into the fray. One of his assistants, Buckley, was sitting there talking to Jeff Meyer, and Crean just starts going off on him and yelling, "You know what you did? You wrecked our program. You destroyed our program," with a camera like right in his face. It was fantastic. And the Buckley kind of like puts his arm around him and leads him back.
My first problem with that is that, assuming that Meyer wrecked their program, Tom Crean wasn't the coach when he wrecked their program. So it wasn't his program to wreck.
No, he got the job because they wrecked the program. Like, he should be thanking Jeff Meyer. Thank you for screwing up that program so bad that they hired me.
Well, this is not the first feud that Tom Crean's gotten involved in since he's been in Indiana and, frankly, when he was in Marquette. Wasn't a couple years ago there a somewhat publicized Twitter feud after he wrote some stuff about the Xavier staff?
Yeah, he is Tom Crean has enemies in just about every coaching staff in America, I think. There aren't a whole lot of people who seem to like him except for the people that are on his team, you know, in his coaching staff. And even some of them don't like him from what I understand. So very, very different cat for sure. The one thing that that came from this was an article by Mike DeCourcy, who is a Hall of Famer, and I don't want to sound disrespectful, but this article is weak. I mean, really weak. Mike's whole argument here is after that, and he didn't want to blame that one incident for it. He also, you know, referenced Huggins and Gillen not shaking hands back in the day.
Jesus.
He referenced some other incidents between coaches, but he said, whatever the case, it's entirely unnecessary, and that's a lesson that hasn't been learned over nearly two decades. This cliched post-game ceremony serves no purpose. Sportsmanship? A made-for-TV handshake between two competitors who may or may not have cause for mutual distaste says nothing about sportsmanship. Sportsmanship is about playing by the rules of the game in all phases, recruiting, scouting, the actual contest, and doing nothing that would cause an opponent undue harm. While I agree with that last sentiment, and he brings up somewhat a good point about that, sportsmanship isn't, you know, what you say in a post-game press conference or what you do when you're shaking hands. It has to do with how you're recruiting and how you're acting on the court. I agree with that. But shaking hands goes back a little bit farther than just some made-for-TV cliche. I mean, it's a pretty standard thing. And the biggest problem I have with this whole argument is that it's really that big of a deal that we can't ask two grown men to look like civilized human beings after a college basketball game. And in the case that we're talking about right now, Tom Crean and Jeff Meyer, a great college basketball game, we can't expect them to walk across the court, shake hands, and just move on with their day, whether they like each other or not. I don't care if it's cliche. I don't care if it doesn't mean anything, if it's fake. What's the big deal? I mean, it is a TV format. As a media member, DeCourcy should want this to happen because, first of all, this is the funniest thing that can come out of it is when the coaches feud. Like, this is great for us media guys. I don't know what DeCourcy's problem is, but the fact that he thinks we literally need to remove handshake, and his arguments for it are terrible. Like, he's like, this doesn't happen in any other sport. Well, that's completely false.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have never seen two baseball managers shake hands on the field after a game.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah, he's right about that, and he says that. But he also says the same thing about the NBA. While they don't line up and do it like they do college style, those guys always go over and embrace each other, shake hands after the game. They just do it in a less formal style, sort of like they do in the NFL. And, I mean, well, like he mentions in this article again, Crean learned from the best in that case because his brother-in-law, Jim Harbaugh, started that big uproar with what's his name?
Pete Carroll.
From the Lions.
Well, no, he did it before that when he was at Stanford when he had the big fight with Pete Carroll.
Right.
The what's your deal responded to what's your deal. I actually sympathize with DeCourcy to a certain extent, and I kind of agree with what Snow was saying. I mean, I don't need to see this sort of pantomime of the coaches going and shaking hands and honestly, I don't need to see it. If they want to stalk off angry like they actually are, it really doesn't change the experience for me. And in fact, honestly, a little bit of, we know there's friction between coaches and between staffs from following the recruiting, but it kind of increases the intrigue to me. I mean, how much ink was spilled about that Harbaugh whoever the dude is from Detroit, I don't know his name, the coach from there, that whole thing. It was like a week's worth of sports.
Oh, Schwartz. Schwartz.
Jim Schwartz. Yeah. There was a lot of press given to how much those two teams disliked each other. You know what? I don't mind that.
Right, because they shake hands, not because they don't shake hands. I want it to happen. If you're pissed off, be an asshole when you shake hands. That's fine with me.
So what you're saying is that you like the pantomime, the sort of stage play of it, because someone might misbehave.
Yeah, because it makes you man up. And when you can't do that, then you react and you make a fool of yourself for us all to write about and laugh at for the next week. But I mean, it's just ridiculous to me that because of these things, we have to say, oh, we can't shake hands anymore after a game. I mean, come on. I don't think they should have to shake hands, but to say that we shouldn't do it, come on.
All right. This is going to be buried like 80 minutes deep in a Xavier podcast that very few people will hear. Based on your years on the recruiting circuit, who is the most disliked coach in America?
Tom Crean.
No doubt?
No doubt. The second most would be Cal. But
now, is Cal disliked
completely
because
different
of his
reasons.
Success or because of his personality?
I think biggest reason he's disliked is because of the perceived way he goes about his success. I don't necessarily agree that he's doing things that aren't on the up and up, but that perception is certainly out there. And whether or not coaches are just jealous or they truly believe he's cheating, they treat it like he's cheating. And there are definitely coaches who will make comments. I've heard them. They make them all the time. There are definitely guys out there who do not like Cal, but I would definitely say Crean tops that list of most disliked coaches, and he tops it because people just don't like him. He's a jerk, and he's a weird dude.
So who are some guys that are generally liked on the coaching circuit?
I think Thad Matta's one who a lot of people really like. Very funny, very good personality. There's a lot of guys who that's such a fraternity. I mean, most of those guys get along. I'd say it's probably rarer that they dislike each other than not. But I mean, there are definitely the cases where certain guys don't like each other for whatever reason.
Right, right. Well, I think we're probably at the end of the show at this point, Rick. So this was number 25. We'll retroactively call it the Dante Jackson episode because I forgot to do it at the beginning.
You are slacking on your one duty that we give you on a week-to-week basis on this podcast, and you're slacking, Dan.
That's fair.
Well,
that is fair.
For Dan, I'm Rick. This was the 25th edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. Thanks for listening, everyone.